finale of Castel Nuovo Tedesco's Guitar Concerto No. 1 in D. The soloist was Eduardo Fernandez with the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Miguel Gomez Martinez. I hope that sunny music has set you up for a really great afternoon. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'll be back next week at the usual time of 9 o'clock, so hopefully I'll see you then. Sunday Morning is a tandem production for BBC Radio 3. Thanks to my producer Sam Phillips and our studio manager in London's broadcasting house, Paul Kitchener.
Just say play BBC News to most smart speakers and you'll get the latest national, international and now local stories that matter to you.
Hello, this is BBC News, our top stories.
For your news when you want it, just say play BBC News.
Well, it's just after midday and time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the writer Catherine Rundle.
Catherine Rundle started writing for children at the age of only 21. In little more than a decade, she's become one of our leading children's writers, with 6 books so far, including the award-winning Rooftoppers, the story of a girl who travels across the rooftops of Paris looking for her mother. Catherine herself is a roof climber and a tightrope walker, of which more later. Born in 1987, she grew up in Zimbabwe and Brussels. After taking her undergraduate degree at Oxford, she was elected a Fellow of All Souls College, where she wrote her PhD thesis on John Donne. Her book on that great metaphysical poet was published earlier this year to celebrate the 450th anniversary of his birth. You're a huge fan of Donne, Catherine, obviously, as the title of your book reveals, Super Infinite. Why should we be reading, remembering him now?
I think John Donne was unlike anybody else in his ability to lay out the strangeness and alchemical nature of humanity, that we are so breathtaking and so deeply annoying, that we are so dark and so full of joy and hope, that we are such a bewildering mix, and he laid out that mix astonishingly.
The fascinating thing about your book, I think, is that you tackle his work with the same kind of hunger and excitement as exists in his writing. Is that fair?
I hope so. I think John Donne, being one of those strange and alchemical creatures, needs writing about him, that salute, that sort of hunger that he had for the world. He was somebody who faced deep, deep sorrow in his lifetime and yet insisted unremittingly on awe. And for that, I think we can turn to him for ways that we might untangle our lives now, today.
Many brilliant composers have loved Donne too, and we're going to begin and end the programme with settings of his poems. In between, we have Fauré, Miles Davis, Strauss and Mozart. But we're starting, as I think we rightly should, with Donne, with a setting of Break of Day, widely thought to be by Donne, made in the early 17th century by the English composer William Corkeen. So, in fact, it was produced in Donne's lifetime, wasn't it?
It was. And the Break of Day is in some ways a sister poem to The Sun Rising. Both of them are about the sun coming up and therefore causing the lovers to part. And there's a sense of the urgency and the romance of two lovers being together and the sun coming to disturb the clarity of their togetherness. And The Break of Day is, like most John Donne poems, full of puns and wordplay and a kind of saluting of how language and thinking itself can be a kind of sensual sexual pleasure.
'Tis true, 'tis day, what though it be, and will you therefore rise from me? Why should we rise? Why should we rise? Because 'tis light, did we lie down? Because 'twas night, love that in spite of darkness brought us hither, in spite of light should keep us still together. In spite of light should keep us still together, in spite of light should keep us still together. Light hath no tongue, but is all eye. If it could speak as well as spy, this were the worst, this were the worst that it could say, that being well I fain would stay, and that I love my heart and honour sore, that I would not from him that hath them go. And that I love my heart and honour so, that I will not from him that hath them go. Is business that doth you remove? Oh, that's the worst disease of love. The poor, the foul, the false love can admit, but not the miserable man. He that a business hand make love, doth do such wrong as if a married man should woo. He that a business hand make love, doth do such wrong as if a married man should
woo. Paul Hillier performing Break of Day, William Corkine setting of John Donne. The lutenist was Nigel North. One of the qualities you were talking about there in Donne, Catherine, seems very much a theme in your own work, and that's the fight to discover joy despite the grief and loss involved in living.
Absolutely. So I think John Donne, he was one who, he faced absolute horror. He lost 6 babies, he lost his wife to childbirth when she was only 32, he lost his brother when he was 19 to plague. And yet he still insisted relentlessly that it is an astonishment to be alive, and it behoves you therefore to be astonished. And I think for my own life, when I was young, I had always reckoned that it is very difficult and it is also staggeringly beautiful to be alive. And I think that is something that I want to infuse through all my children's books, this sense that, yes, you're right to be afraid, be brave anyway.
So they can be told the truth about the darker side of life.
I think they absolutely can. My children's books are, broadly speaking, sort of wildly unlikely adventure stories. But I think that they have a kernel in them, a sense that, yes, it is hard to stride through this world. It is hard to face the sorrows that will undoubtedly come. And yet, the only thing larger than the world's chaos are its miracles. And I think if you think of something like Paddington Bear, the way that Michael Bond sort of baked into his stories this offering to children that, yes, yes, it will be hard, but for every one of Paddington's chaoses, there is always something that sort of turns out exquisite. If you think of it, Paddington might see a burglar and he sort of stops the burglar, and you suddenly realise that he is stopping the burglar with the sandwich that he dropped earlier on the floor, that every mistake he makes eventually has something beautiful in it. And, you know, I think that children's books can point out large truths.
In your book, The Good Thieves, you write about a girl whose grandmother has just died, and her grandfather is really submerged by grief. And it seemed to me, reading it, that you're setting out to teach children about bereavement and how they might help the old people in their family.
Yes, I think I wanted to write a book that would be about seeing someone else's sorrow and loving so recklessly, so utterly, that you try to take that sorrow into your own world and transform it. I think if you were an 11-year-old, you would think that The Good Thieves was about a little girl who performs a heist in New York City to steal back the things that have been taken from her grandfather. But I think if you were an adult, you would see that it's also about this sense that faced with loss, it is possible to find something large within it that has joy in it.
All of what you've said could suggest that your books are gritty, but in fact, they're quite romantic, aren't they? Even quasi-magical.
I hope so. I would reckon that they sort of sit in the space between possible and impossible. They are things about, you know, children riding wolves across Russia and living up on the rooftops of Paris and going on these wild adventures. Wound into that, there are these truths about the world, I think. But I also want children to have a plot that will grab them by the wrist and drag them onwards.
This music we're going to hear next relates to your own childhood in Zimbabwe, because your father was an aid worker, your mum was a teacher, and this Strauss, I think, brings back memories of quite wild dances.
Exactly that. My parents fostered children. I had two foster siblings for my whole childhood. And one of my strongest memories is of my mother, who is much taller than me and very beautiful. She used to take us one by one by the hands and sweep us up in the kitchen in Zimbabwe. If you picture a large white kitchen filled with geckos and lizards that would wander in. And she used to swing us round in her arms, and she used to sing the pom-poms of the waltz. And I do think, looking back, that it is one of the greatest strokes of luck you can have, to be loved as a child by somebody who knows about love. And my parents did know a great deal about love.
Thank you.
Maris Janssens conducting the Vienna Philharmonic in music from the Blue Danube Waltz by Johann Strauss. All that whirling around to Strauss clearly gave you an appetite for heights, Catherine, and terrifying physical feats. I mentioned at the beginning that you're into tightrope walking, roof climbing. How did that start? And, well, which roofs have you climbed?
The roof climbing started with just a love of heights, with being quite a shy child and loving the idea of being able to get up high and see the world stretched out below you and being able to watch without being watched.
Of course, sometimes I suppose this is on the edge of legality. But are you terrified when you're doing that? Or in fact, is that part of the fun, the adrenaline rush?
I am a little bit terrified. I tend not to do things which, if I fell, I would die. So it's less to do with being afraid than with being able to temporarily unmoor your sense of terror from your sense of adventure. And the compensations are so colossal. What you see up above a city late at night is what you get to see almost no other time. It's entirely your own. It's laid out. It shines. It looks different and older and stranger. And that is what I go in pursuit of. And then when I got to Oxford, I discovered the tradition of the Oxbridge night climbers. And I started climbing a bit more seriously. And when I was elected to All Souls College, I was told that there is a trapdoor above the lavatory above the library, which will lead you through a tower up onto the rooftop. And from there, you can get the whole way around the rooftop of All Souls College. And it was while I was up there one night at about 2 o'clock in the morning that I found an empty glass bottle of beer that someone had left up there and started thinking, well, what if somebody lived up on these rooftops? What if there is a whole landscape that we miss because we fail to look up? And that is how the book Rooftoppers was born.
That book, Rooftoppers, is about a group of children who climb the rooftops of Paris. And I think that does actually relate to the next music.
It does. Fauré's Requiem is a piece of music that the main character's mother plays, but she plays it double time. And it's a chase across the rooftops trying to hear this music. And I think the idea behind the double time was the idea that the Requiem is sorrow, but that even in sorrow, one can seek out delight.
Was your mother musical?
Very. My mother loves opera. My brother was a classical musician for quite a long time before he became a vicar. And music was always in the house, and indeed often some Fauré was in the house.
Thank you.
In Paradisum from the Requiem in D minor by Gabriel Fauré. Ivor Bolton conducting the Baal Symphony Orchestra and the Balthasar Neumann Choir. Such joyful peace in that Fauré Requiem. It's about finding peace even through loss, isn't it?
It is. And it means a lot to me in part because I lost my own sister when I was 10. She was 16, and it was the great lasting tragedy of my life. And my sister was, in fact, not my biological sister. She was my foster sister. And my parents fostered throughout my childhood. And the thing I now admire them for so wildly, though I didn't realise it at the time, was the will of iron it must have taken to allow us such freedom, that we were allowed to play unsupervised, that we were allowed to run off and climb trees and disappear for whole afternoons. And now I don't have children myself, but I have a nephew and niece, and my instinct is to, you know, a little bit of me wants to give them cotton wool shoes and keep them away from sharp objects for the next 18 years. And their willingness to let us be a little bit wild and run a little bit free, I am so grateful for that. I think that is one of the greatest gifts you can give a child.
You have a brother as well, Gerard, who started out as a professional musician, a percussionist, but he's now become a priest. And I think it was probably thanks to him that you discovered jazz.
That's true. He did a great deal of very good older brotherly work. He gave me many, many pieces of great music. And Miles Davis especially became great, great passion of mine. When I was first elected to All Souls, I used to work very long hours in a way that you can when you're in your 20s. So I used to wake up at about 4 in the morning and work on my fiction. And then when the day started at about 9, I would then teach Shakespeare, work on my doctorate. And so by the evenings, I would start to be utterly exhausted. But I found that if you play Miles Davis, it's like a starting pistol going off in your head. It really is remarkable. And so that is one of the reasons I love him. He kept me awake.
So this is Miles Davis, his music for Louis Malle's first film, Elevator to the Gallows, improvised by the musicians after they'd just seen the first edit of the film.
Thank you.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's staggering.
Miles Davis with music from his 1957 album, Elevator to the Gallows, taken from his improvised score to the Louis Malle film. I suppose when you're climbing, rooftopping, you're improvising to a certain extent.
Yes, I suppose there is something about rooftopping that has a little elements of dance to it, in that you have to be extremely aware of your body and that you do it only for delight. There's no other reason to do it.
You've written, as I said, 6 children's books now, Catherine Rundle, and won awards as a so-called children's writer. But you don't think that children's books are just for children. You've written a book to persuade adults to read them. Why you should read children's books, even though you're so old and wise. So tell me, why?
Children's books traffic in the imagination. And sometimes in adulthood, after the necessary compromises that adult life involves, we start to think of the imagination as an optional extra, and we start to allow it to be trammelled and curtailed by daily life. But the imagination is the condition precedent for political change and for love itself. It is the only way that you can really crowbar open the world to see it truly. And so it's not that I would argue at all that children's books are the only books that adults should read. I would gladly lay my life at the feet of Hilary Mantel if she didn't. I'm sure she would find that embarrassing. But more the idea that occasionally they are the books to which we can turn to find something that is offered nowhere else. In part because they're short. Children won't hang around while you kind of pontificate and elongate. They're a distillation of some of our most vulnerable desires, of our hopes and our wishes, of our sense of ourselves as deeply at the mercy of chance and the world. And as such, I think they're kind of, you know, that distilling a kind of literary vodka quality to them. You can have one in a short, sharp shock and it can shift your day.
A much-loved Bach cantata now. Music that has a genuinely comforting feel to it.
Ah, this is one of my favourite pieces of music in the world for its sense of beauty and its sense of joy. The idea that the beauty of it might allow you to take yourself somewhere new. This, I think, is a piece of music that is in part about joy and in part about the miraculous. There's a brilliant poem by Seamus Heaney Badgers, which has the line, "How perilous is it to choose not to love the life we're shown?" And I always think of that when I think of this cantata.
I don't know if you agree, Catherine Rundle, that there is something about the joyous sense of completion and peace in that music, which is very like the foray, has very similar effect.
Absolutely. They feel like cousins, don't they? The same sense of wonder in them.
Masaki Suzuki conducting the Bach Collegium Japan in the final chorale, Jesus Shall Remain My Joy, from the cantata BWV 147 by Johann Sebastian Bach. Mozart next, a composer you love for his playfulness, and you've chosen the finale from his great opera, The Marriage of Figaro.
Yes, Artis, I think, has everything in it. That moment when the Count begs the Countess for forgiveness, and that pause before she responds, and the way it just sort of bites at your heart, the joyful wildness of Mozart's imagination. It's like being defibrillated with just pure joy. Gente, gente, allarmi, allarmi! Il padrone! Gente, gente, aiuto, aiuto! Son perduto! Cosa vende, cosa vende? Io scelerò Tommasani, Tommai Fama, Tommai Conquistatore! Son sordito, sbaglio, dico, non di non mi fate, e son sordito, il padre resistete, uscite, madama, il premio avete di vostro onestà. Faccio, mia figlia, la madre, ma la mano scoperta e la trama e la perdita è qua, la perdita è qua.
Perdono,
perdono.
Ma non vostro,
perdono, perdono, la mano non va a farlo.
Thank you.
John Elliott Gardiner conducting the English Baroque soloists in the finale from Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. A live recording from 2004, led by Bryn Terwyl as Figaro, and we heard Rodney Gilfrey and Hilary Martin-Pelto as the Count and Countess. There's something redemptive in a Shakespearean sense, isn't there, about that final reconciliation of husband and wife?
It is. It is exactly Shakespearean, isn't it? The same sort of desire for symmetry, for catharsis. You know, the sort of Puck-like Jack shall have Jill and all shall go well. And in it, a kind of playfulness, the quality of someone willing to lay out a game and see how it plays, the kind of delight of that.
And then after the reconciliation, Mozart, Shakespeare-like, picks it up with lightness and wit, saying perhaps, well, people are like that. It doesn't really matter, così fan tutte, in fact, unless the music is saying something else.
Yes, there's always the question, is the music acting slightly at odds to the lyric? But that, I think, that slight tension that we're left with, the same as the Shakespearean tensions at the end of the comedies. How seriously should you take this delight that we are being presented with, and how far does it have a caveat in it? I love that.
Reading your book about John Donne, Catherine, I was very struck by your account of the finale of his life in March 1631. He really prepared for his death as if it were some grand theatrical event, didn't he?
He did. In some ways, he was still that boy who understood the power of good clothes. He posed for his own funereal monument in his winding sheet, as if he were a corpse. And then he took the picture as a sort of incredibly personalised memento mori and laid it by his bed in his preparation for death. And as he felt death coming, he laid his arms across his chest to prepare himself as if he had already been laid out by the embalmers. And his final words are supposed to have been, "I were miserable if I might not die." He understood a theatrical gesture.
But also he turned his demise into a work of art in itself.
He did. With his final sermon, Death's Duel, it is one of the saddest and most beautiful things he wrote. He wrote that your mother's womb is akin to a winding sheet, that we come to seek the grave. But he also ended that sermon in the sense of redemption, for him, heavenly redemption, and a sense that there would be a great striding forwards after death. And it was so much part of his whole attitude that he had this sense of deep, deep darkness and sadness. But he would also say things in sermons like, "Not to show joy is a stupidity. That is a contempt." And, you know, it was his whole mixture of dread and hope and delight and grief and loss, this bundle of conflicting emotion that he laid out so clearly.
And those very words, "I were miserable if I might not die," suggest that he saw it as the completion of life's circle.
I think he either truly did or wished to make himself believe it. But I think it may well have been the former. I think he may have believed that in death he would finally be reunited with the god he had been summoning his whole life.
He certainly achieved immortality anyway. I don't know whether he knew that that would be the case, but it certainly is.
Yes, whether or not he knew his poetry would be read, probably not. He treated it with great contempt and, you know, flung it all around Renaissance London. So perhaps he didn't realise that we'd be talking about him 400 years later.
He'd be very pleased that you like it so much. We're going to remember John Donne now with our last music. And this is by the contemporary American composer John Adams, setting one of Donne's best-known religious poems, "Batter My Heart, Three-Personed God." It's from the opera Dr. Atomic, about the scientists who built the atomic bomb. And I can't help wondering what John Donne would have made of that.
I think he would have been startled. And also, I hope, delighted that people were still finding something new and fresh in work that was so new and fresh 450 years ago.
Well, Catherine Rundle, thank you very much for talking about John Donne in such refreshing terms, and also about your children's books. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
imprison me, for I accept you and throw me. Never shall be free, nor ever chaste, except you ravish me.
Gerald Finlay is singing Batter My Heart, the setting of John Donne's poem from John Adams' opera Dr. Atomic. Edward Gardner was conducting the London Philharmonic Orchestra. And that was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, Catherine Rundell. The episode was produced by Elizabeth Burke and it was a Loftus Media production. The programme returns next Sunday at noon when Michael's guest will be the writer Christopher de Belaigue. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock. Time for the latest news, read by me, John Shea. The Trade Minister, Penny Mordaunt, has become the latest candidate to announce she's running for leadership of the Conservative Party and Prime Minister. 8 other Tory MPs have announced campaigns, including the former Health Secretaries Jeremy Hunt and Sajid Javid. The Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss, is expected to launch a bid within the next 24 hours. The issue of tax cuts is dominating debate today. This morning, Mr. Javid told the BBC he would implement tax cuts amounting to £39 billion a year, which would include scrapping the government's national insurance rise and bringing forward a cut of a penny off the basic rate of tax. The Shadow Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, has said only Labour can give the country a fresh start. She claimed none of the candidates to be Prime Minister had voted with Labour against the national insurance rise. 15 people have been killed when a Russian rocket reportedly hit an apartment building in the east of Ukraine. At least 20 more are believed to be buried under the rubble in the town of Chasiv Yar. The attack came despite Russia's declaration of a pause in its military offensive to take the eastern Donbass region. Police in South Africa say at least 15 people have been shot dead in a bar in the township of Soweto. The victims are believed to be between 19 and 35 years old. It's reported the gunmen started firing randomly at a group of young people. No motive for the attack has been established. Pope Francis has expressed solidarity with the people of Sri Lanka, who he said continued to suffer from political and economic instability. Protesters are still occupying President Rajapaksa's mansion, insisting they won't leave until he honours his promise to resign on Wednesday. 3 small boats carrying more than 140 people have been intercepted crossing the Channel to the UK so far this weekend. The Ministry of Defence says the total number of people attempting to make the dangerous journey so far this year stands at around 13,200. Tennis. Crowds are arriving at Wimbledon's centre court for the men's singles final between Novak Djokovic and Nick Kyrgios. A win for Djokovic would be his 21st Grand Slam singles title, while Kyrgios is trying to win his first. The Met Office has issued a Level 3 heatwave alert for parts of England, as temperatures are expected to reach 32 degrees Celsius in London and the South East. The warning is from 9 o'clock tomorrow morning until Friday. And today's weather, it'll be dry and fine for most of the UK, with just some lingering cloud over western Scotland and Irish Sea coastal areas.